Hey everyone, I am so excited to share this episode that technically I may have recorded last summer. A lot of things came up. I kind of slowed down sharing different podcast episodes for Michelle is Money Hungry, did a rebrand, but I always held on to a lot of episodes that were recorded in the last year that I haven't had a chance to share. This is one of them. So a couple of things. I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Kane from High Fiving Dollars in this episode. There's a lot of background noise because the day that I was supposed to record this episode, my block had no electricity. So I ended up having to run to a local coffee shop to record. Yeah. Fun times. Very frustrating, but she gives a lot of really interesting feedback, commentary, just a lot to think about in this episode. Also, there's a point where I talk extensively about freelance writing and my views on it. My views have changed a little bit. I actually really enjoy, and I do mention this in the episode, I really enjoy writing, but what has always been a little irritating to me has been the business side of freelance writing. And I wanted to briefly touch on that. I still get a little crazy about the business side of freelance writing, but one of the things that I've realized in the past year is there is a place for it in terms of growing revenue and the type of business that I'm growing. I do think that most freelance writers, especially ones like myself who get irritated by some of the like people paying late, things like that, you have to have probably three times the number of clients that you have. So that's just a reality. I'm still very much focused on passive income. I had several things kind of come up last year personally. And so I kind of took my foot off the gas and, or rather put my foot on the brakes and slowed things down. And so I'm happy to say that I'm still very much focused on passive income. And this year in particular, I'm really focusing on growing it and am happy to report that that's starting to finally come together. So hopefully by this time next year, the episode will be a little different and reflect all of the earnings coming from passive income, because my ultimate goal is to have that be my number one revenue generator. And then writing just as a way to grow my brand versus as something that I have to do to add to the revenue streams in my business. I also talked about setting an audacious financial goal. Last year, I did not meet that goal. I ended up having several things kind of come up and then life happened. So I've set that goal again and I'm really looking forward to seeing if I can kick it out of the ballpark. So with that being said, I hope you enjoy this episode. Again, I do apologize for the noise. Imagine you're in a coffee shop. That's where I was. Yes, but Sarah shares so much great wisdom. It's a great episode. So thank you. Make sure you subscribe and share with friends. Finally, for those of you who are looking for a community for entrepreneurs, looking to better your networking skills, please do check out the Unapologetically Money Hungry Closed Facebook group. I've created that group to kind of help people get in front of other people, figure out ways to grow your brand and how to connect with other people organically daily as you grow your business. For those of you who have a website, make sure you are using SiteGround. I am a proud affiliate of SiteGround. Very excited to change my websites from HostGator and Bluehost over to SiteGround. I think I'll have a much better experience with customer service, responsiveness, and they're dealing with fewer people. It's not like the McDonald's of blog hosting. So I will share a link to a post I wrote about why I'm breaking up with Bluehost and HostGator, because I have two websites. One is hosted on Bluehost, the other on HostGator, moving them over to SiteGround, and I think it's going to be a great fit. If you are looking for help with networking, please do schedule a 20-minute coaching call with me. We'll work through one thing, because it's 20 minutes, one issue that you're dealing with, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you about whatever that might be. A scheduling link will be shared in the show notes as well. So if you are looking to better your network, better your networking skills, deal with a certain issue, schedule time to speak with me. Excited to speak with you today about all things business, freelancing, putting yourself out there. I'm geeking out about this topic with a friend of mine who also is in the personal finance blogosphere. So Sarah, welcome. Please do introduce yourself and tell the listeners, like tell us, who the hell are you? Why do you think I'm interviewing you today?
So my name's Sarah, and I call myself a money storyteller because most of my work, my blog, and just talking with other people in the personal finance community really revolves around your journey and your mindset, and ultimately the story around your money, because all of us have really different backgrounds and goals and aspirations. And I think the idea of a money story is a really fitting way to talk about it. If you want to talk about my boring job title, I'm a freelance writer for finance companies and education companies, and I also work from home with a very rambunctious 2-year-old who is not home today.
So could you share a little bit about what you've been doing recently and some of the outreach that you've done? You've been on a ton of podcasts, and a little bit about your personal finance story, because it definitely loops back into some of the professional things that you've done and some professional changes that you've just mentioned to me prior to us beginning the recording.
Right. So I'll talk a little bit about the professional changes and yeah, about that. So I became a freelance writer for a few reasons. Number one, I'm actually originally from Canada and my husband's from the US, and we made the decision to move to the US. It just made more sense for us overall. And so I knew that as a teacher, I had to, transfer my teaching license, or I would have had to redo everything. And I just didn't necessarily want to stop producing income while that happened. And so I thought, what would be a good way to earn some money while I figure all that stuff out? And freelance writing seems a really great fit. And along the way, I fell pregnant, gave birth, and I thought, I do not want to go back to a job. I want to be at home with my son while he's still young. And so that's really been the catalyst of why I do freelance writing. And I do enjoy writing. So it's not something I hate, thankfully. And the companies I work for overall have been really great and supportive in my mission to help, talk about money mindset and spread the idea of how financial literacy can really change your life. So that's been really something I'm really grateful for to have the opportunity to do.
I didn't realize that you've been freelancing for over 2 years. I had no idea. I thought it was more of a recent thing. So you're now in a period of transition. And before we talk about that, could you talk a little bit more about being in the freelancing space and how that worked for you, how you made that profitable? If you hear a little background noise, today I'm in a coffee shop due to unexplained circumstances or unexpected circumstances, so just bear with me, lovely listeners. So could you talk about how you went into freelancing? Were you working with companies that were in the U.S. and Canada? Like, how did you kind of build that up so that it was sustainable?
Okay,
and
good
was
question.
It worth it?
Okay, so, gosh, long story or short story?
Whichever one you feel like.
Okay, so When I actually fell into very accidentally, I wasn't really expecting to turn freelancing into a full-time thing. So initially when my husband and I were talking about moving back to the U.S., this was about, I believe, 4 years ago. And so I had to go through the whole green card process, whatever. And it was very intense because we were in China at the time. And,
oh my God, you know, yeah.
So long story short, we're like, let's just move back to the U.S. and you know, make sure that my green card's okay and whatever, whatever. And so we did move back, and it ended up being a long period of unemployment just for various reasons. And so I'm sitting there upset, like I'm not making any money, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what can I do? And I just started randomly searching online, and I actually stumbled across Carol Tice's blog called Make a Living Writing.
Oh,
and I thought, how interesting. Like, you can get paid for blogging. I had absolutely no idea. And I don't know where else I found this list of guest blogs that pay. So I just started pitching, and I think I pitched about six blogs, and about five of them got approved. And I think each of them paid $50. So I ended up making, oh gosh, I can't do math right now.
Like $300 or whatever.
Yeah. Couple hundred dollars right then. I thought, oh, how neat that I'm getting paid to write from my laptop. And so that's what I started doing. And it really helped ease the stress of unemployment. I mean, clearly I wasn't making the equivalent of what I was making at a job, but that really helped. And then we ended up moving back to China. My husband ended up getting a teaching job, and I did shortly after that. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to continue this as a side hustle thing, because I don't want to be in that position where I'm moving to the US again, don't have a job, or a really difficult transition to get a full-time job. And so that's what I kept doing. And it was just fun. And again, long story short, you know, I gave birth, and I thought, wow, this is a perfect opportunity home. I was reading blogs about work-at-home mothers and how they made it work. Kat Alford was, you know, one that I just read a lot. Mm-hmm. And then how she made it work with twins. And I believe, I don't remember the other ones, but she just comes to mind immediately. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try to make it work. And so when we moved back last year in June 2016, I basically said, okay, I'm going to just pause my teaching career. I'm not going to return to it, but if I don't want to, then I have freelance writing to fall back on. As far as getting clients, most of them were from the U.S. I just thought, for me, tax purposes, it was just a much easier than to get international clients. And clients in Canada were very hesitant to hire U.S. residents. Even though I'm a Canadian citizen, I don't pay taxes there anymore because I don't live there anymore. So they were very hesitant to hire me, even though I was a Canadian. I am Canadian because of tax purposes. Yeah. And so I thought, okay, just easier to approach companies in the U.S. And so a lot of it was outreach through emails. And funnily enough, I actually did a guest blog on a blog called Careful Sense about international freelancing and some of the best options to get paid. And from that one guest blog, I think I had about three or four clients approach me.
How many?
To write various things. Of three or four just approach me. Yeah, and it was really cool. I was writing about subject matters that I had no previous experience in, but because I had international experience where I was living overseas, that gave me an advantage over other candidates. And, you know, I just kept emailing and pitching. Sometimes I did have to get up in the middle of the night to make phone calls, but, you know, I did what I had to do. Luckily, a lot of them were on the West Coast, so I was able to make the time difference work for me. And then I just kept getting referrals, and that's really how I transitioned into full-time.
So to clarify, you were in China pitching people in the U.S., and so you would get up, like, in the middle of the night or what have you, just so that you were on the same time as your potential future clients. And I think the thing that I'm curious about that I always want to ask people, how many pitches were you sending out a week or a day? Like, what was your process so that you could build up income? So, you know, one of the things I realized when I began freelancing was I did not have enough clients for a couple reasons. One is clients come and go. And so I think that there's always a constant onboarding that needs to be happening, which means that there should be probably a constant pitching. So there's a dog looking at me outside the window. It's really funny. So I'm wondering, how often were you pitching? The dog is so funny.
Sorry. How often were you pitching, and was it daily, weekly? Did you have metrics? For someone who's listening to this and thinking about becoming a freelancer, I think that that's something that's really helpful. Like, was there a minimum number of clients that you were always trying to have? And how did you approach compensation? You're not writing for $50 at this point. So
no.
kind of, if you could talk about that, that would be wonderful.
Sure. So in the beginning, it was about like just pitching any and every company, which I don't necessarily recommend. It was probably not the smartest idea, but at that point I really didn't have any experience about niching down. It took me a while to figure out what a good niche was for me, and a profitable one at the same time. So I just was pitching SEO companies, online marketing companies. I'm trying to remember what else. Just any. And I bought lists off Fiverr.
Oh.
And yeah, so I bought lists off Fiverr.
Wait, explain this. What do you mean you bought lists from Fiverr?
Okay, so you can go on Fiverr, and I think it's called web scraping or web research. I'm not really sure what it is, but you can go and find somebody for really cheap and say, I want a list of companies in, I don't know, the Seattle area, and they are in the tech industry. And they would come back. Yeah, they would come back to you with a list of companies. Now, they're not all that great. I think I don't remember how much I paid back in the day, but I would pay for, you know, their email address, a contact person. I think it didn't matter the point which contact person was, as long as there was a valid email and the company name. And so I did something called a mail merge, which is kind of like mass emailing people, but you personalize it. And so that's what I ended up doing. And I think I emailed thousands of companies that way, which isn't smart because I mean, the return on my investment was very low. Like, I mean, of thousands and thousands of companies, maybe I worked with like 1% or less than 1% of them. Oh. And then they were low paying. So that was really what I did initially. Then I got a little bit wiser and I was like, well, now I've got this experience under my belt. What are some of the companies that were paying me pretty decently? And so it ended up being textbook companies and finance companies. And so I thought, okay, let me focus on those. And so I just started Googling companies and blogs. And so then I would focus on the marketing manager or the communications director, or if there was an editor for the blog, I would then pitch the editors and I would say, hey, my name's Sarah. These are the publications I've written for. I'm looking for writers. And so I would follow up with these people as well. I'd follow up every 2 weeks or a month, depending on how often I was, you know, that we were in contact. And so then they would say, yes, I'm looking for this and this and this. And I was really lowballing my rates. I don't really remember how much I charged at that point. I think I was asking people and they were like, oh, a reasonable rate for a blog post would be this. And I would just literally say, okay, well, if my friend says this, or if this person in this Facebook group says it's this much, that's how much I'll quote.
Oh, so how did you raise your rates?
So one of the ways I did it was with a previous client. I realized I really liked interviews, like interview type articles. And so he was actually firing a bunch of his writers, and I thought, like, okay, yeah, and I'm like, okay, well, I have nothing to lose. If he's gonna not fire me, but like he was letting people go because he didn't have the content, or not the content, he didn't have the budget for it. And I was like, okay, what do I have to lose? If he says no, I'm gonna be out of a gig anyways, no matter what, if I say something or not. And I said, hey, listen, this is what you need on your blog. This is why your blog sucks. I mean, I didn't mean to say sucks, but this is why your blog sucks as well. Here is my skills as an interviewer, and this is how much I'm going to charge. And I think it was double what I was making with him. And he said yes. And so I was like, hey, this is so cool. Now I learn that if I make a few suggestions and offer up why my skills are perfect for your company, I can totally make more. And so I started doing that with bigger companies. And I pitched, like, I did pitch Amex, I can't even remember back then what I pitched, but I started getting braver and braver pitching bigger name blogs. And I would say, you know, not only do I have this portfolio, under my belt, I have these interviews because I have experience with, I don't know, whatever subset of personal finance I had, or I have all these connections in this particular niche that you like to write about. So you don't even have to sort, like, get sources from me. I can find them. Like, I would just start naming things that I think would be super valuable. And that's how I raise my rates. it saved you time, you know, with particular with knowing a lot of people in, let's say, the real estate crowdfunding industry. That was what I was writing about a lot in the past. Uh-huh. And I would say, hey, you don't have to source these people. I can do it. Like, I'll literally email them. They'll reply to me in 5 minutes. I can get you articles pretty quickly because I'm not spending time scrambling, or you're not spending time finding the perfect source for you. So you're saving time and energy, and they would say yes. So that's what I ended up doing.
I love this story because you're talking about being bold and seeking out opportunities and just really leveraging what you already know in order to get the outcome that you want. So what are some of the downsides that you experienced as a freelancer, and what are you doing moving forward?
Okay. So it's been about a year since I've been full-time freelancing. And so one of the, you know, we talked about this before the recording, that the thing that really, I think, threw me in for a loop was the idea of the mental bandwidth. And so I got into thinking I'm going to stay at home with my kid and he'll go to daycare a couple times a week. Right. Great. But, you know, kids go through changes. They're needy. And, you know, I was just, you know, telling the story when he had 4 of his molar teeth come in, and he was just in pain. And of course he wants his mom. At that point, like, what do you do? Do you, you know, type an article, or do you sit with your son while he falls asleep? You know? And so it ended up being long days. I had to turn down work because I knew I couldn't meet deadlines, or I was afraid I wouldn't meet deadlines. And so I ended up losing a few clients, unfortunately, that way. It's been difficult because of the transition as well from China to the US. I don't really know anybody here. There's no family nearby. So the support system for me hasn't been that great. I mean, I have friends I can Skype and things like that, but it's really different compared to having somebody physically here. And all of those things have been extremely stressful, on top of constantly pitching clients, you know, having to deal with not being paid on time sometimes, no matter how good your intentions are, or, you know, clients letting you go, or you having to let go of clients, the volatile nature of freelancing as we know it. And so that to me has been extremely stressful. I mean, I've managed to make it work, and I've had to deal with really low to no income months. And so freelancing is not for the faint-hearted, especially in the beginning when you're building up your clientele.
You know, it's really interesting because I, prior to us recording this call, we were talking, and I said point blank that I effing hate freelancing. And it's funny, it's not the writing that's the issue. Of course, right when I start talking, they start making us also. You know what? They haven't made any espresso drinks until just this second. Okay, here we go. I might cut that out. But, you know, the irony, you know, it's so funny because you can make so much money. So when I see, like, my friends, like Holly Johnson, who runs the course Earn More Money Writing, and she's making hundreds of thousands of dollars in freelancing, I'm like, well, she also used to work with dead people, and so she's never going to go back to that because she used to work in a mortuary. She's like, I am never going to go back to that. So she will put up with some of the hassles that I think come up with freelancing. For me, I felt like I was working for a lot of people, even though we frame it as clients. And so when I initially left my job, my goal was to grow passive income. And I found freelancing to be very distracting from the actual goal. But the problem is you have to eat.
Yes.
And so I kind of, I'm glad that I did it the way that I did it. But this year, I was like, I would rather let go of my clients and spend some time, even if it means I'm a little broke, spend some time really growing my affiliate income, with my passive income, which is really where my focus is, than to focus on freelancing, because ultimately I don't want to manage client expectations. I don't want to do edits. I don't want to be pitching. I don't want to deal with any of that. But I'm glad that I did do that, so that if I wanted to pitch a client so that I could do a couple of posts for exposure, getting paid, mind you, but for exposure to grow my brand, I can use those skills in a way to grow my company and my business versus this is how I'm living. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, I mean, we were like, oh, we should hit record once we got into this podcast, but I'll repeat it for those who obviously weren't there for that conversation. We're talking about the idea of sacrifices, or what are you willing to put up with? And so freelancing offers so many opportunities. And in Holly Johnson, definitely check her out. Like, she is doing so awesome. And, you know, she does write about boring subjects. I think we all have at one point.
All of us do, yeah.
Right. And it's not, you know, and there's nothing wrong with giving that up. There's nothing wrong with sticking around or whatever. I think don't compare what you've done with other people. And for me, it was really, when I first started getting into freelance writing, I had this really romantic notion of it. Like, oh, I have a big schedule. Like, or not a big schedule. Like, I have my own schedule. I can do whatever I want.
Freedom.
I get, you know, take, yeah. And, but then you know what? You can easily work yourself into a job with freelance writing.
That's
which,
right.
Which has happened to me. I won't be afraid to admit it. And I had this, you know, really romantic notion of like, oh, I can set my own schedule. Therefore, you know, when my son takes a nap, I'll just whip out an article because I'm a really fast typer. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't happen. I mean, kids are very unpredictable, and I can't just stick them in a corner all day and, you know, do whatever.
Put them in a cage somewhere.
Yeah, put them in a cage, you know. and I think also, when you make choices, right, you know, the idea of opportunity cost, like what are you giving up to make that choice you're making? Mm-hmm. Or what are you willing to give up to keep that choice, you know, in other words? And so, you know, I don't want to speculate on what Holly is doing, but for me, it was like, am I willing to give up a bit of a social life moving to this town? Am I, you know, while I'm freelancing, am I willing to be... to give up my teaching career for a while? Am I willing to stay at home with my son and put up with the potty training and the teething and all that? You know, like, I mean, there's all these things that you kind of have to think about. And for those who are, you know, just starting freelancing or struggling with it, you know, just know that there are things you're going to have to, like, I don't want to say give up, but there are things that you can't do right now as a result of choices you're making. And know that freelance writers face that all the time. I mean, think about, like, if I work for this client, I'm giving up time for a potential client that will pay me more. Or, you know, if I'm writing this really boring article, I'm taking time away from growing my affiliate marketing or whatever it is. And so I think there's a lot of, it's a bigger mental hurdle than I think people realize. It's not, oh, I'm going to do a lot of outreach and then I'm just going to start getting a bunch of referrals and I'll have time then to grow my blog. It's like, that doesn't happen. You have to constantly market because you can't always rely on referrals, or you can't always rely on a retainer client being there forever. You know,
exactly.
I, at one point, right before I moved to the US, I had three really good retainer clients and then they all let me go.
Whoa.
Because one of them, I did such a good job. Like, I created such effective systems that I actually worked myself out of a job, which I suppose was a compliment. I'm not sure. And the other two wanted somebody local. Okay. Hey, cool. You know, we all parted very amicably, but I had lost essentially my entire paycheck right there.
Wow.
Right. And then there's that mental, you know, shift you have to make, like, okay, now I got to pitch again. I got to deal with this loss of income. And like a lot of your, and I don't know, I mean, I would love to hear other people's thoughts on this, you know, about the whole self-esteem thing too. Like, you're defining yourself by income. You're defining yourself by the kind of clients you have, you know, and all that other stuff that kind of goes into it.
it's really fun, like, funny listening to you talk about this, because these were some of the things that I dealt with, and I'd already dealt with working a job, like my actual job, before I quit, that messed with my self-esteem and stressed me out. And I was like, why am I doing something that's messing with my self-esteem and stressing me out that I'm not absolutely 100% in love with? By the way, dear listeners, Holly Johnson is a dear friend, and so I think she would think it's hilarious that I was joking about the mortuary thing, because I know that girl is not going back to that. I'm actually going to drop the affiliate link for her course into the show notes, so if you are like, I am excited to do freelance writing, she is definitely the resource, in my view, for how to go from zero to making good money and just the systems and things like that. So definitely, if you're interested in purchasing that course, please do. She's awesome. She's a rock star. But I'm telling you, she's never going to go back to working at a mortuary, so she's going to make her money. And I don't blame her at all. I think a lot of it is also just what you're willing to deal with and what you're wanting. And so for me, my goal has always been passive income. And one of the things I've noticed recently with a lot of friends who have gotten into freelancing, it's almost like the multi-level marketing of freelance writing in the personal finance blogosphere, where everyone's like, we're freelance writing.
Yes.
And it's funny to me, because it feels like, because so many of us are doing it, that it's deplenishing, is that even a word, the amount of jobs that are available out there, because there's only so many of us writing about this topic. So I think, you know, it's really interesting, because it kind of feels like everyone becomes a freelancer, and then I'm noticing that people are saying, well, I'm doing so much client related work that I can't grow the stuff that I want to grow. And so I think that's something to be really mindful of. Like, maybe you have, you know, if you're working full time, focus on growing what you want to grow first before quitting, and then doing freelancing if you want to supplement your income in that way. Because a lot of people I know are struggling with that balance right now, because you have to eat, you know.
Yeah.
And that's real.
Yeah, and I think I don't want to speak for anyone's behalf, but I know a lot of people who went into a freelance type career because they hated their jobs, or, you know, they have this idea of like, oh, I can go on vacation and work at the same time. You know, cool. I mean, I'm not saying that's not true, right? I mean, I'm very thankful because, you know, I've been able to move halfway across the world and still make income, you know, from freelance writing. So that I'll always be grateful for. But, you know, don't always do something as a stepping stone to something else, because you're going to grow to resent that stepping stone. Mm. And if freelance writing is purely a money-making thing for you as a stepping stone to something else, fine, but be really careful of not setting maybe an end date to it, or you know, giving it like a time period and testing it out before you call it quits or you continue with it. Because I think that you know, if you resent what you're doing, then how is it any better than the job that you left?
Yeah, meta on us right then.
Yeah, I was like, woo. But it was because I was reading this book. I hope it's not on a tangent, but it's by the co-founder of Mind Valley, and it's called The Code of the Mind Valley. So it's a personal development website, and they sell courses on meditation. It's actually really cool. They give a lot of free stuff away. Yes. And so anyway, so he wrote this book, and he was talking about setting goals and how we suck at setting goals. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And he's like, there's a difference between a means goal and an ends goal. Mm. And a means goal is a goal that you're setting so that you can do something else, or so that you can reach whatever. And an ends goal is just a goal in itself. And that when you're striving towards it, the journey is just as much fun as reaching it. And number two, when you actually do attain that goal, like, there's no other their goal after that. Like, it's just, let's say your goal is to, I don't know, travel to the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Like, that's a big goal of mine. I would love to do that.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
That to me is an end goal, because once I get there, I'm just gonna be so excited, because that's, you know, to me, the experience of going to Russia and China, whatever, like, that's awesome. But for example, freelancing is a means goal for me right now, because it is a means for me to earn money while I stay at home with my son. Mm-hmm. And so the means goal sometimes can get really sucky, especially if it's something we don't necessarily want to do, or there's no bigger driving factor for it, if that makes sense. And so
it totally does.
And so for some people, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I want to quit my job. 9 to 5 sucks, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know what? Let's stop. Like, why is it that you hate your job? Like, maybe you like your industry, but you hate your employer. Or, you know, for me, that was, I remember when I was still teaching in China, that's really what happened. My very first teaching job, I loved it, but I hated my employer. There were a lot of, I'm not going to go into detail, but there were a lot of shady things going on. And so when I switched employers, it was actually much better for me. And so that's what you have to ask yourself, you know, and even with freelance writing, where you're talking with clients or when you're setting your own schedules, like what is it that I'm actually, why am I doing these things? Like, is it, because I don't want to do something? Because when you do something because you don't want to do something else, it's not a very good reason.
So I wanted to talk about two other things in this interview. First is, you teach ESL. And it's really, English as a second language for you guys. We're like, what's ESL? And it's really funny to me because I was in ESL in that industry for 10 years. That was I was a student services coordinator for a language program here in Colorado. I absolutely loved it until I hated it. and it took a really long time to hate it because it was one of those passion jobs. Like, I was very passionate about doing it. And do you see yourself going back to that? I find that there are a lot of educators who go into work for themselves or digital marketing. And I find that very fascinating, actually, how many people who are in the field of education who transition into digital business. And so I guess what I want to know is, do you see yourself going back into, you know, regular, like working for a program like that, which are a lot of times very heart-centered for the people who work in them? And have you noticed the sheer number of educators going into online business that, like I have? Like, I find it fascinating.
Yeah. So I think for one, I can't remember what the statistic was, but it was like teachers within the first 5 years end up quitting because they're so burnt out for various reasons. Because it is, I'm not saying it's the most demanding job, because it's not, but it is a very demanding job. And, you know, for me, I think I was really burnt out from it, not because of the actual teaching, it was everything else around it. And I think for a lot of teachers, they would probably say the same thing. You know, despite the pay, we're not going to argue about the pay. That's, you know, that's totally a whole different story.
Right.
But it's just, you know, a lot of, yeah, I mean, you can talk about paperwork, politics, you know, maybe there's not enough funding for supplies, whatever. There's a whole, you know, various reasons. And so for me, I do see myself going back to it. I do miss it. I love teaching kids. That was something I never thought I would enjoy. So I was actually certified as a high school English and art teacher. And I always thought that I would teach older kids. When I went to China, they were like, oh, you're teaching grade 2.
Aww.
And I thought, okay. And it was an interesting experience because it was a, so I worked in international schools, which are different than language learning centers. So international schools are basically the same kinds of schools you get in the US, except you're in a foreign country. Ooh. And so you are teaching expat kids, but there are also local kids that go to these schools. And so I would be teaching the US curriculum, like, you know, completely in English to kids that may not actually have a really good grasp on the English language. And so that was a challenge. But I was a really good teacher, and I am still a really good teacher. I'm not afraid to say it, and I loved it, and I'm really good at what I do, and I've, you know, produced some really incredible results for my students. I'm really proud of the work that I've done in my teaching career, and just hearing, like, my husband talk about his experience right now teaching at high school, I was like, oh, man, I totally miss the interaction with the students. Mm-hmm. And so if I transition back into a teaching career, I'm not opposed to it. I'll probably do it myself a little bit older. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with jobs, and I don't think there's anything wrong with teachers who leave the profession, because I completely understand how stressful it is. And it's really interesting about the online business stuff, because I know a number of teachers are doing it, but they're actually teaching online courses, so they're not teaching, they're just doing it a different way.
So this leads me to my next part of the, you know, what I'd love to talk to you about, which is personal finance. So we're in the personal finance blogosphere, and I would love to know a little bit about your backstory, how you got into writing about personal finance. Do you have a mission regarding why you're in the blogosphere for that? Like, why are you still talking about money? Like, what is your goal with that? So if you could tell people a little bit about your background and in terms of personal finance and your story, I think that would be really interesting.
Sure. So I don't want to call it infamous story, but it did land me on stage at FinCon, which is a
which was
big
awesome.
Club,
I saw that.
Which is a big conference. Yeah. So it did end up landing me on stage, which was crazy. So I was pretty young and naive at 23, moved overseas to Australia. And I knew how to manage money. That wasn't the problem. The issue was I had a boyfriend at boyfriend that moved with me, and I felt this pressure to take care of him. And so I did. I ended up paying for most of his stuff. We went on road trip across Australia, New Zealand. I thought he was the one. I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally going to be a responsible adult. Now I'm going to be back to Canada, get a full-time job, buy a house, and we're going to get married. And that didn't happen. He broke up with me 2 weeks after I moved back to Canada. So I had no job prospects at the time, because there's certain times of year where you can apply for teaching jobs, and so I went back at not a good time. So I ended up having to move back with my parents. I had no money in the bank, and then I realized, oh my gosh, I have $9,000 worth of credit card debt. Like, how did I get myself into this situation? And it took a lot of inner work. It wasn't budgeting or saving. Like, I was always a naturally frugal person. I totally understood what budgeting was, and I knew all that logical stuff. And for me, what I discovered was there's all this emotional stuff tied into money. Whether or not we want to admit it, you know, our self-esteem is tied into it, how we feel about ourselves and our worth, our skills, about the world is all tied into money. And it totally affects our behavior. So for me in that particular, with that particular situation, I think deep down I just was chasing this romantic fantasy. Like, I thought this person was going to be the one, and we're going to have this like ideal relationship, and I just threw money at it thinking that it's somehow going to work out. Mm-hmm. And so my mission with talking about money is to talk about all that stuff around it. I mean, there's, you know, some really great bloggers that really break down investment topics, you know, into layman's terms, and like how to budget, how to think about that. But I'm more interested in exploring the idea of self-worth as it relates to money. How does your mental health tie into how you manage your finances and all that mindset stuff? Because I noticed this with my kids as well. Not my kids, my students when I was teaching, is that it's really easy to teach kids once you have them believing that they can do it, once you have them believing that somebody trusts them enough to push beyond what they think is capable of, what they think they're capable of. And I believe the same with adults and money, is that once there's this trust in place, whether it's you trust yourself or you can confide in somebody, so you create this kind of safe environment to take risks, and you believe you can push yourself beyond whatever comfort zone you're in, then that's when you can really make strides with financial freedom. And financial freedom or retirement or whatever the term is really just a symptom or a reflection of you getting your stuff together.
You know, I really love that this is your focus, because one of the most challenging parts of my personal finance journey has been mindset. Like, that has been the thing that I've worked the hardest on. It hasn't been habits, because once you figure out the bad habits and you work on the good ones, you know, it becomes second nature. You know, once you establish a routine and system so that you can be successful, mindset has been like, it's really blown me away, actually, how much mindset has driven a lot of my decisions. It wasn't even just lack of information. It was just, you know, not believing certain things, like not believing that I could make as much money as I would like to make this year. So I've made a very large earnings goal for the next 12 months, like starting June on. And before, I think that if I'd made that goal, I wouldn't have
in my heart of hearts really believed I could do it, you know. But I've worked so much on mindset, I feel like, you know what, I can do it. I have to put the work in, but I can do it. Likewise, being, you know, working on paying off debt, it's, you know, it's been a process, but it's not just an issue of knowledge about how to purchase things without debt. It was also understanding that I could. And so, for me, it's been really an interesting journey and very challenging, because who wants to work on mindset? Like, when you work on yourself, you know what I mean? Like, because you're admitting, mm-hmm. it feels like you're admitting that there's something wrong with you. And for me, I'm like, there was nothing wrong with me. It's just that I've been, how would I like to say this? I think that we've all been taught one thing to encourage us to be, in the U.S., to encourage us to be consumers versus growing our money. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So yes, exactly.
Before, you know, for those of you who don't know the history of how, like, credit kind of came to be, credit cards are still a pretty relatively new invention. Like, they came out in the 1950s when they did the MasterCard credit card drop in San Francisco. And basically what happened was, credit card was created because this group of businessmen went out to eat, and one of them, I feel like one of them didn't have enough money, so they figured out, they had like a eureka moment and figured out a system, which basically was the credit card. And then they did the credit card drop in San Francisco, and I'm going to double check the story, and then people got into credit cards. But before that, people used to purchase things with cash, and they waited, and no one felt like they were missing out on stuff. And so I just feel like I've been working on deprogramming myself for the past, like, since I started blogging about money. It's just been basically deprogramming. I feel like I'm in some, like, sci-fi movie where they're, like, electrocuting myself each time I want to, like, pay for something with a credit card. They're like, no, don't do it. You know, but it goes back to mindset about waiting for something and not feeling like your fear of missing out and YOLO and all that. And it's been a very, very interesting experience. That was a little bit of a mind meander, but I do think that not enough people are talking about mindset versus some of the dry stuff, which is like budgeting and systems and apps. And I think there's obviously value in that, but if we don't focus on the why, it's hard to address any of the other issues.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think for me, that's been a major eye-opening discovery is that. And I think with just going back to my teaching experience, like, I remember people coming to me like, how did you get kids to do this stuff? And one of my proudest moments is I had a group of kids who could barely read and write English just because, you know, for various reasons. And I within 5 months, I had them designing their own website, a tourism website from scratch. Aww. Yeah, and it's actually really proud. Anyways, I'm just really proud of those kids with that. And I remember thinking, like, yeah, like, how did I get them? Not that how did I get them to do this, but, like, why were they able to achieve this? Which people were in disbelief because they were like, how, like, you got a grade one kid who barely spoke English to write paragraphs.
These are little kids.
Yeah, these were little kids. They were like grade one and two. And I remember it was number one, I didn't let them give up. Number two, I was honest about how hard it was, but that if they trusted me to guide them, then they would be able to do it. And I was like, oh, this totally relates to money as well, is that, like, this stuff's hard. I mean, it is. Let's just, you know, budgeting's easy, but, like, actually implementing it, or implementing an investment plan, or not spending on, I don't know, Gucci handbags or whatever, that stuff's hard. Like, but you have to believe that you can do it, and you have to put the right systems in place where there is trust. Like, you have to trust yourself that you can do it. And I think it, you know, ultimately goes back to the idea of, like, am I enough, right? The idea of the consumer culture and advertising it's kind of tied back into the idea of like, hey, you suck at this or you're not enough at this, and here's a prog that will, you know, magically change your life. And that's why people kind of, a lot of people buy into it because they think it's like the easy solution, right? Whereas if you, I don't know, let's say stop buying coffee. Let's say you stop buying clothes for a month. Like, that is more difficult than putting it on a credit card and paying it later, like working part later for some people because they don't want to deprive themselves or whatever. I'm totally going off on tangent with this, but you get what I'm trying to say.
No, I totally do. And actually, while you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that, so when I was little, I lived in Japan, but I was little. So I think that my experience with money is very different, obviously, going from childhood to being an adult. But I want to ask you about how you perceived money interactions, just the money lifestyle in China, because you were in China, versus what you would see in like the U.S. and Canada, and what perhaps we could learn from it, or what kind of changes you're seeing in China in terms of money. So, and kind of where I'm going with this is, I know that with my friends from Asia, or even if they're first generation here, that they have a big focus on a couple things, which is no debt, period, end of story, high earnings, and cash. And so I'm wondering, did you observe some of this when you were in China, and what could we implement in our financial lives here in the U.S.?
Yeah, China's really interesting because they didn't really, I don't want to say they're capitalist, but they're more capitalist, I think, within the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years. And so, like, a lot of things are very new to them. And designer goods are very, still very new. And a lot of people equate that with status and it being able to afford it. So in a lot of ways, things are the same in terms of that. But people are willing to sacrifice income to take care of their family. That's a kind of a huge thing that I've noticed. Maybe it's a little bit different than here, I suppose. Parents are willing to take out large amounts of loans to send their kids overseas in hopes that the kids get a really good job and then they will support them when they're older. The idea of retirement is not really the same as the U.S. I mean, there are, you know, banks that invest and things like that, but for a lot of people, they don't really trust it, especially the lower class individuals. They rather have the physical cash there.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of retirement is more like, hey, my kids can take care of me when they're older, which I don't know. It started to shift a lot, but. But yeah, people still handle things in cash. Like when I first moved back to the U.S., it was so weird to use a credit card. It was really weird to use a credit card because I was used to using debit and cash. And people there too, like they don't necessarily buy big ticket items unless they have the cash saved for it. So it's really common for a lot of people to buy a car outright in cash, to buy houses outright in cash, or their parents would give them property. Things like that. The idea of loans, I don't have much experience with that because I don't really talk to many people about it, but there are government programs in place where they help you set aside money to pay for a house.
Oh, wow.
So there's kind of things like that in place there, but I believe, you know, for a lot of people, I think it's that new money mentality, like, I have all this money and I don't have to be scared of spending it, so I'm going to.
Ooh.
And but then the people who do, you know, I call them old money, but the old money will then like try to keep it within their family. So there's that. It's really interesting just to observe the changes in the last couple of years with that even. The younger generation go overseas, or a lot of it's going to change too. The idea of retirement is probably going to change. The idea of investing will probably change. And the idea of consumerism is going to change as well. But I don't think the idea of buying something for status symbol is going to stop anytime soon there.
And before we wrap up, what is your number one goal with what you're doing? And I know that you've been speaking on a ton of podcasts, and like, why are you putting yourself out there? Like, what is your intention with that? And where can we find you? What's your social media? What's your website? Just give us all the details.
Okay. So my intention is all the things we talk about, the mindset, like focus on that and focus on believing you are enough. It sounds really cheesy, but it's true. And whatever decisions you make, base it on the fact that you are enough, and based on the fact on what will increase your overall happiness, and how is money going to play into that? Because once you've figured all that out, and once you have the self-confidence or the trust that that you're going to make the best decision based on what's good for you at the time, all of that other what stuff, like, or not what, how, like how you budget, how do you invest, how do you retire, all that stuff is going to fall into place magically. And I want to just shout that from the rooftops, is figure out the why, figure out the what, figure out how you're going to get yourself to feeling like you're enough, and everything. I don't want to say it's easy, but it will fall into place a lot easier at that point. So you can definitely find me at highfivingdollars.com. That's where I blog a lot about this stuff. I'm on Instagram at Sarah Lee Kane, and I'm also on Twitter at Sarah Lee Kane.
Thank you, Sarah, so much for joining me. I try to keep these short, but you were just so interesting. There's just so much to talk about. And I am just so excited to watch what you're doing, to support what you're doing. It's so needed. There aren't enough people talking about money. It's funny because people in the personal finance blogosphere, I think sometimes we feel like there's so many of us. And I think when you really look at the fact that there's only like 1,300 people in our FinCon community Facebook group, and so maybe there's a few more who aren't in the group, and there's 300 million Americans, and then there's all the other people that are being served by international bloggers who are also in the community. You know, if there's someone out there who's like, you know, I love talking about money, and I have this money story that I want to share, please do share it, because there aren't enough people out there talking about money. And really, it's, if you are able to empower someone to make decisions that are in their best interest financially, please do. Please talk about it.
Yes.
And with that is a wrap.
Woo!